From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Iraq, after American soldiers are gone. Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Republican candidates are roasting President Obama for leaving Iraq too soon, but it was George W. Bush who negotiated withdrawal by the end of this year. As C-130 troop transports fly out of Baghdad, have both administrations been more concerned about domestic politics than policy in the Middle East? Did the deaths of so many Iraqi civilians mean U.S. troops had to go? Can Iraq's armed forces keep the peace? Is President Maliki another strong man? In 9 years, 4,500 Americans died, 32,000 were wounded, and 100,000 Iraqis lost their lives. The dollar cost was $823 billion. We'll ask, what's next? First the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. American troops will be out of Iraq in just 3 weeks, leaving the world's largest embassy and an uncertain legacy. We'll hear some disturbing assessments of what the future might bring. On Reporter's Notebook, physicists all over the world today were waiting for evidence of the so-called God particle, potential key to finding out why physical matter exists. We'll hear what was reported. First, this news update. President Obama has asked Iran to return the unmanned surveillance drone that crashed, apparently on its territory. President Ahmadinejad today said he wants an apology before he even considers that possibility. He said, "We now have control of this plane." Josh Gerstein is White House reporter for Politico. Josh, good to have you back on our program.
Hi, Warren. Great to be back with you.
How likely is it that Iran is going to give this thing back?
Very unlikely. I think even U.S. officials, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta has said that he doesn't expect to get it back. I believe someone at the State Department said the U.S. is not holding its breath. So there's really very little reason to see, frankly, why the Iranians would give it back to us.
When the president of Iran goes on television like that, I think it was Venezuelan television, and sort of taunts the United States, what does that say about relations between our countries?
Well, that's pretty much the vein in which these relations have been developing and continuing over the last few months. You know, there had been some hope among Obama administration officials that when President Obama came in, there would be a thawing of relations with Tehran. It didn't work out that way. We saw rather brutal crackdown on political dissent in Iran, and then the relationship really hasn't improved markedly. Perhaps the most startling episode recently was this revelation a couple months ago that Iranian security officials allegedly conspired to kill a Saudi diplomat here in Washington. So it's definitely something where you have these charges and countercharges being exchanged by both sides in a pretty vituperative kind of way.
When the Iranians showed pictures of what they said was the drone, there was some indication that maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was some kind of mock-up or something. Is it now pretty well accepted? Has the U.S. Admitted that that's what it is?
Yeah, the U.S. has basically, they won't get into the details of what technology was on board or precisely what type or model it was, but you've had officials up and down the chain from President Obama, as I say, down to Secretary Panetta saying that it's a U.S. Craft and that the U.S. would like to get it back. It appears to be a stealth drone. We use these Predator-type drones for various operations around the world and even occasionally in the U.S., but this is a special model that's designed to be stealthy so that it can fly without easy detection by radar or other kinds of equipment that a country we're trying to surveil might have.
Former Vice President Cheney has said what the Obama administration should have done was go into Iran with some kind of missile and destroy the drone.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably possible that that could have been done. Apparently, according to the Wall Street Journal and others, it was actually considered soon after the U.S. military realized that this weapon had disappeared, or I shouldn't call it a weapon because it's unarmed, but this aircraft had disappeared, that there was a possibility of going in and trying to destroy it either with a missile strike or perhaps sending an aircraft in. I think the Iranians would have viewed that as even more provocative than sending an unarmed aircraft into their territory without their consent. And it really raises the question of just how important it is to prevent this from getting into the Iranians' hands. If the technology was really incredibly important, you could see a reason perhaps to to run the risk of that kind of a provocation if it's really something that we'd rather them not have their hands on, but that a lot of our potential enemies around the world know about already, it probably wouldn't be worth provoking some sort of retaliation from the Iranians, which, you know, could be directed to Afghanistan, where we have a lot of troops still at this point.
Is flying a surveillance drone over somebody else's territory in itself provocative enough to be called an act of war?
I don't know if it would necessarily be considered an act of war. It's just an aircraft that doesn't have any weaponry on it. It can be fitted with weaponry, but in this case wasn't. So I would say it's a violation of Iranian sovereignty to send an aircraft there, unless you could make clear that it was part of some specific kind of military attack. I probably wouldn't describe it as an act of war, but as I say, sending a missile in or an armed aircraft to try to destroy it would probably be getting into that territory.
And it's still not clear exactly how secret the technology on board really is.
Right. There's two areas where I think the U.S. would be concerned. One would be the capabilities of this aircraft. In other words, this stealth technology, would we want it to fall into the hands of, forget the Iranians, what about the Chinese or the Russians who might use it to our disadvantage? But I think also on a tactical level, it might be possible to recover from that drone some indications of what the flight path was that we directed it on and what installations or areas in Iran we have a particular interest in. And obviously the Iranians would be able to figure out things from that about our intelligence and possibly take steps to move whatever nuclear equipment or they might have in those areas to another location. So there's two different kinds of concerns, some of them very similar to the concerns we had when the back in May, you may remember that stealth helicopter crashed during the Osama bin Laden operation in Pakistan. Within days, there were reports that the Chinese were trying to look at it.
Okay, Josh Gerstein, White House reporter for Politico. Thanks, as always, for being on our program. In a moment, Iraq, after American soldiers are gone, on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Out of 170,000 U.S. troops that have been to Iraq in the past 9 years, 6,000 are left. In 3 weeks, they'll be gone, too. Tomorrow at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, President Obama will give thanks for sacrifices that have been made for what he once called a dumb war. Yesterday, with President Nouri al-Maliki at his side, he said this about the immediate future.
What's absolutely clear is, as a consequence of the enormous sacrifices that have been made by American soldiers and civilians, American troops and civilians, as well as the courage of the Iraqi people, that what we have now achieved is an Iraq that is self-governing, that is inclusive, and that has enormous potential.
Liz Sly is Baghdad Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Liz Sly, thank you very much for joining us today. Are the Iraqis are Iraqis glad to see American troops leave?
Well, to tell you the truth, the vast majority of them don't believe that they're going. So it's really hard to get a sense of how glad or otherwise they are. America has been such a huge part of their lives. The invasion has had has been such a huge impact on their lives that they actually don't believe the Americans are going. I think one reason for that is that they can't actually believe the Americans are going at this moment, given that so much remains uncertain in the country and so little is resolved. But when you push them on this issue, they are kind of emotionally glad, but their heads are very worried.
Emotionally glad because of all of the civilians that were killed?
Yes, there is certainly a perspective here that the Americans have caused huge damage to this country in terms of the amount of blood that was spilled. I think that that doesn't register necessarily with the U.S. military and perhaps not even with all Americans. But Iraqis remember overall the amount of bloodshed that this invasion has brought And that, I think, is something that will never be forgiven. And so when I try and tell them, look, hang on, the Americans are leaving. I'm telling you for a fact they're leaving. And then they say, well, it's good because they're occupiers and we don't want occupiers and they spilled blood and they shouldn't stay. However, we're really worried about what's going to happen next.
Does that have to do with what we saw for so many months, sectarian violence? The president, we just heard say that the government of Iraq is inclusive, but that appears perhaps not to be the case.
Well, it is on paper inclusive. The Iraqi bloc, which includes a lot of Sunnis, has for the first time in this eight-year period actually clawed back some of its losses from the Saddam that it suffered from the loss of Saddam Hussein as the president, and they do now occupy some very significant positions in the Iraqi government. But there are deep concerns about the extent to which Maliki is moving to kind of assert his own authority over the government in rather, some would say, extra-constitutional ways by just putting his own people in key security positions and basically using the security forces.
We seem to have lost the communication with Liz Sly, who is, again, a Washington Post Baghdad bureau chief. She has a perspective on that conflict, which also includes the work she's done in Syria and Lebanon and elsewhere in that part of the world. Also with us today is Anthony Cordesman. He's an analyst at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. And, Mr. Cordesman, it's a privilege to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
A pleasure.
Are you concerned about what we just heard or what we began to hear from Liz Sly about President Maliki, the way he is operating at this point?
Well, I think we need to be concerned more broadly. The structure that we created around the Constitution really never properly defined the role of the Council of the Republic, the legislature. It attempted to limit the power of the president, but it gave him authority in ways where whoever drafted it was less concerned with money and military appointments than theoretical lines of authority. They've never really resolved how to manage the provincial and local government structures, although that has improved over time. And here we are, nearly 2 years after the last election. You really don't have a functioning cabinet. You don't have a Minister of Interior who's in charge of the internal security forces. And the Prime Minister is acting as Minister of Defense in part because a body which also is not part of the Constitution but was supposed to be a mix of Sunni and Shiite parties with the head or the leading opposition figure, Alawi, has never been able to work. We really need to be extremely cautious about exactly what's happening there. And certainly Maliki has attempted to centralize power, but the problem goes far deeper than Maliki.
Thank you for calling him Prime Minister. I called him President earlier, and that is not the office that he holds. How concerned are you, Anthony Cordesman, about the sectarian issues?
Well, I think, again, we need to be very concerned. The reason that the U.S. tried to keep troops was the risk of bringing back Sunni and Shiite tension in an insurgency. But more than that, the real fear that clashes in the north between the Kurds and the Arabs could turn into a significant new form of fighting, and that at best it needed a buffer so it could be resolved peacefully. We look at the levels of violence and the way that the U.S. tends to count violence in terms of significant acts, still shows a relatively high count. But if you look at other ways of counting, which are sort of terrorist and lower levels of violence, the counts that are used, for example, by the Counterterrorism Center still show a very high level of violence inside Iraq, and reports by another U.S. official indicated that the pattern of violence was rising as U.S. forces went down.
Anthony Cordesman, once again at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Liz Sly is back on the line now, again, Washington Post Baghdad Bureau Chief. And Liz, I'm interested in, and you're picking up where Anthony Cordesman left off. How much violence do you see, and why weren't American soldiers allowed to stay longer in larger numbers?
Well, on the levels of violence, I don't think we see any significant trend at the moment. If you look at the violence trends over the past years, they've gone down every year since the surge, and we're not seeing anything significant enough to say that you can say anything about where it's going at this point as the U.S. troops leave. Everybody's bracing for an increase in attacks because they're expecting some of the groups to try and make like a splash and grab the headlines away from the soldiers as they're leaving and to create the impression that the Americans are going home under a big cloud of violence. But we haven't seen that happen yet. What we are seeing is a lot of low-level assassinations and small bombs that keep everybody on edge and remind you that this isn't a safe city yet at all. But it's not what we've seen in previous years. It's definitely much safer than we've seen it before.
Go ahead.
In terms of why they weren't able to stay, I mean, the bottom line came down to the fact that it was the question of giving immunity to U.S. troops. U.S. troops do not deploy anywhere in the world without guarantees of immunity from prosecution from local authorities if they are on duty. And such is the level of bitterness amongst Iraqis for shootings and killings that have happened in the past and gone unpunished, that they just weren't prepared to grant that immunity.
You spent some time in one city where a particularly a horrendous incident occurred. Tell us a little bit about what you heard from Iraqis there.
Well, what I heard from them was a sort of bottomless pit of hatred and bitterness that will, I think, never go away. I don't think there'll ever be any chance that America could go into that part of the country again and be perceived with anything but anger and hatred. It was, I mean, of course, it is an exceptional case because it's not often that the soldiers kill 24 people in the space of about an hour. And clearly this was an act that was triggered by the extremely dangerous circumstances at the time in that town. They had just been hit by a roadside bomb. They were scared and angry, and they shot 24 Iraqis. But it's incidents like that, big and small, all over the country, accumulated over several years. That mean when you talk to the Iraqis about what their memory of the Americans is, they really remember mostly the killing.
Liz Sly, again, Washington Post bureau chief for in Baghdad. Mr. Cordesman, back to you at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Considering the original rationale for this war, the way it was planned, the way the occupation was conducted after the war itself, was this a success or a failure?
I think that if you look at it, we don't know what the output is going to be yet. And we're probably about 2 years away from knowing. We don't have a stable central government. It still has to show whether it can effectively use its resources, budget, develop the oil sector. When you look at the economy, the average per capita income is about 161st in the world. That's substantially lower than it was in 2003. When you look at, again, and I think we need to be careful about levels of violence here, because I think what Liz is referring to, again, is significant acts. That's not the way, the only way the U.S. monitors violence. And if you look at another index, which is people killed, injured, or kidnapped in acts of terrorism, not only is the level still very high, it's higher in Iraq than it is in Afghanistan, and those come from the United States government. We look at the cost of this, and it's, even if we ignore our allies in the Iraqis, it's 4,000 American dead, well over 30,000 wounded, and $800 billion. Now, given the fact that millions of Iraqis were displaced, that even conservative estimates put about 100,000 Iraqi killed, that several hundred thousand were wounded, was getting rid of Saddam when there weren't weapons of mass destruction and links to terrorism worth the cost in dollars and blood? The answer is probably not.
Liz Sly, when you go to other countries in the region, what do you hear from them about the impact of the war in Iraq?
Well, most people look on the war in Iraq as evidence of something that they don't want to happen to them. And I think it's done a lot of long-term damage to America's reputation in the region, a lot of long-term damage to America's ability to influence events in the region, not only because Americans themselves have no wish to wage war in the Middle East anytime soon, but also because a lot of people in the region just see how much it has weakened America's reach and influence, and how politically upsetting this was for America. And therefore, I think the losses to America's prestige and influence have been immeasurable, and will only be measured and realized perhaps for many, many years to come.
Anthony Cordesman, the same question to you.
Well, I think one has to be very careful. There's been a lot of polling in Iraq, and not by the U.S. government, by the BBC, Germans like the ARD, and so on. It doesn't represent what Liz has just talked about. You have a much more mixed feeling, and it varies very sharply by region. Certainly, Iraqis wanted Americans out. There were many Iraqis who just wanted Americans out, period. It wasn't so much out of anger. It just was the feeling that the United States was not helping. There were other Iraqis that wanted the U.S. out but wanted it to stay longer. More broadly, when you look at polls of the United States and the views in the Arab world, this is not a war that's been popular. But whether it produces any depth or high levels of anger simply doesn't show up with Gallup, Pew, or a whole group of other polls. What it hasn't done is enhance our reputation. What it hasn't done is convince people that we can capably intervene and necessarily serve their interests. But when you look at other polls which ask, do you feel the United States provides a useful security umbrella, for example, in the Gulf, then you get a different reaction, and it's largely decoupled from Iraq. So you have some very, very divided opinions, but what you don't have is any broad base in any of the polls which show that this war led people in the region to feel that we may have had major accomplishments, that we got rid of a horrible dictator and gave the Iraqis a much better life, or that the way we intervened is the right way to intervene.
Thank you both. Anthony Cordesman at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Liz Sly, the Washington Post Baghdad Bureau Chief. Good to have both of you on our program. We'll be back in a moment and continue this conversation on To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warman Ali back with To the Point, once again talking about Iran in the aftermath of American troops. Only 6,000 left at the moment, and by the end of the year, all of them will be gone as well. The largest embassy in the world will be guarded by something like 16,000 civilian contractors, because, as we just heard, the Iraqis refused to provide immunity for American soldiers for anything that they were accused of doing while they were on duty. Again, the drafting of the agreement to have the American troops leave was done during the Bush administration. The Obama administration, of course, is carrying it out. Faisal Istrabadi is a dual Iraqi-U.S. citizen. He was Iraq's deputy ambassador to the United Nations. He drafted the country's interim constitution. He is now director of the Center for the Study of the Middle East at Indiana University. Mr. Ambassador, thank you very much for being on our program.
My pleasure to be with you again.
Why did you sever yourself from the current government of Iraq? You're no longer the ambassador, and you're here at Indiana University.
I am. Well, Indiana University happens to be my alma mater anyway, but uh, I uh, At the time, in 2007, I left at the height of the sectarian violence in Iraq, and I simply felt, I simply felt that the government and many entities within the government were complicit in the ethnic cleansing of Baghdad and other places throughout the country. And I felt no longer able to speak on behalf of that government, so I left.
Are you concerned that that kind of thing will continue now that American troops are gone?
I very much am concerned, as your previous guests also were discussing. The current Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, has made a number of moves which indicate that he intends to continue to act against particularly the Sunnis of Iraq. And this, of course, is likely to lead to a further deterioration in the country and most likely lead to further violence. It's a very, very worrisome sign to me.
Let's hear a bit more of what President Obama had to say yesterday while he was conducting a news conference with the Prime Minister of Iraq, Mr. Maliki.
Mr. Prime Minister, you've said that Iraqis seek democracy, a state of citizens and not sex. So we're partnering to strengthen the institutions upon which Iraq's democracy depends. Free elections, a vibrant press, a strong civil society, professional police and law enforcement that uphold the rule of law, an independent judiciary that delivers justice fairly, and transparent institutions that serve all Iraqis.
Faisal Astrabadi, how close is Iraq to achieving the kind of things that we just heard the president describe?
If this is a checklist of what Iraq needs to do to establish the rule of law and constitutional democracy, Iraq is failing on each of those items. Let me start with, being a lawyer, what's nearest and dearest to my heart, the judiciary. The judiciary has become a rubber stamp for the government. Constitutional cases, a number of constitutional cases have been decided by the Iraqi judiciary, in each case giving Nouri al-Maliki precisely what he wants. He has maintained control over the Interior Ministry, which controls the he is acting Interior Minister, in fact, which controls the internal security structure. He is Nouri al-Maliki is acting Defense Minister, which controls the army, obviously, and he is also acting Minister of State Security. So he has the entire state security infrastructure. He has direct control over the entire state security infrastructure, which, if you recall, is the way that Saddam Hussein rose to power in the 1970s, precisely by controlling the state security infrastructure. We are repeating the same lessons of Iraq's past, unfortunately. Each of these criteria ticked off by President Obama is a cause for deep concern for anybody concerned about democracy and the rule of law in Iraq.
Is there anything the Obama administration should be doing differently from what it is?
Well, I mean, that's hard to say because obviously its influence is somewhat waning. The critical mistake the Obama administration made occurred last year when it threw its entire diplomatic weight behind supporting Nouri al-Maliki, notwithstanding these very worrisome signs which were already in place in 2009 and 2010. The administration lobbied hard, both internally in Iraq and throughout the region, to have Nouri al-Maliki get a second term, which he has done. Right now, the betting, you know, there's some question among Iraq experts whether we'll ever have a set of elections in Iraq worthy of the name. I mean, you can almost get odds a la Las Vegas on that issue amongst Iraq experts. It's a very worrisome thing. What can they do in the future? Well, I suppose it would be useful, it would be helpful, if we stopped hearing this sort of happy talk coming from the administration, whether it's Jim Jeffries in Baghdad, the U.S. ambassador, or whether it's the president himself or other cabinet officers. We're getting a lot of happy talk. We're getting happy talk from the Pentagon about how professional the Iraqi army is, when in fact the Iraqi army chief of staff himself has said it's going to take another 10 years before the Iraqi army can secure the borders. So it would help at least if we would stop hearing the sort of Pollyanna-ish if that's a word, exclamations from the administration about how swimmingly things are going in Iraq, and had a little bit more truth told in public. That would be a very big help to begin with.
Faisal Estrabadi, once again, a former deputy ambassador of Iraq to the United Nations. Lawrence Korb, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. That's a liberal think tank. He was also a former director of national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he was assistant secretary of defense during the Reagan administration. Now, Lawrence Korb, always good to have you on our program, and thanks for joining us today.
Nice to be with you again.
We heard Mr. Estrabadi just referring to Happy Talk. This comes from a president who once called this a dumb war and ran against it when he was campaigning to be president.
Well, there's no doubt about it. I think it's way over optimistic. The only thing I think the reason the president is saying that, he does not want to think all of those, you know, brave men and women who sacrificed, their families who sacrificed so much, that it was done in vain. But I agree. I mean, the last time I was in Iraq in October of 2009 to work with the military to make the transition toward the State Department, I said, Maliki reminds me of Musharraf. You know, at some point, you know, he's going to take over and, you know, he'll be there because he does have control, as the ambassador said, of all of the arms of security.
Musharraf, who, of course, was the general and also president of Pakistan. Well, have these sacrifices that have been made from all we've heard on our program so far been in vain?
Well, the military must do what the country says, and whether you agree or disagree with the war, the Congress did approve it, which I happen to think was a mistake, but they did. But, you know, if you were to have told the American people back in 2003, we're going to go to war for 9 years and lose 4,500 dead, 30,000 physically wounded, hundreds of thousands mentally wounded, and spend, you know, over $1 trillion so Iraq could have an election, you'd have been laughed out of the ballpark. I mean, that's not what we went in for. But, you know, having been through Vietnam myself, you know, it you do feel, well, we did what we were told, and we did the best that we could. So it's not their fault. It really is the idea of going in into a situation that you really didn't understand and trying to, you know, make it better when most of the events are beyond your control.
People in the Bush administration said this was going to be a cakewalk. Mr. Ambassador Estrabadi, back to you. Has anything good of this come of this as far as Iraq is concerned?
Well, of course, we are rid of a heinous and brutal dictator, and I'd like to echo the words of the secretary that I honor the sacrifice of America's brave men and women who were indeed given a mission and who carried it out in a professional and highly competent manner. The problem, I think, has been with the political the political execution, not the military execution. I mean, you have books with titles such as, you know, Winning the War and Losing the Peace. That is not the fault of the military. It's certainly not the men and women under arms. That is the fault of the political leadership. We did get rid of a brutal and heinous dictator, but the cost in Iraqi lives, putting aside for a moment the cost in American lives, the cost in Iraqi lives has certainly been in six figures, minimum of 100,000, if not far more than that. Whether that is a price that was worth it, I think it's very, very difficult to say that it was in retrospect.
Two presidents have been involved in this, obviously. President George W. Bush, who began it, and now President Obama, who is ending it, having once called it a dumb war. Do you think either or both of them was motivated primarily by domestic political concerns, Mr. Ambassador?
Well, I don't think that. I mean, I do believe that the Bush administration, or at least people like Paul Wolfowitz, genuinely believed that they were democratizing the Middle East. So I don't think that the war was launched for any. I don't believe in a cynical explanation for the launching of the war. However, I do think that one of the reasons that politically the political execution of the war was a failure was because both administrations were allowed events on the ground to be and policy to be dictated by an American electoral timetable rather than by the needs on the ground. That was certainly true of the Bush administration, and I think it's no less true. I don't think it's an accident that we are getting a withdrawal of troops in 2011 in advance of the 2012 election.
But wasn't that negotiated by the Bush administration?
It was, that's true, but I suspect that there may have been a slightly hardening of the American position also, because at one point they were actually very close in October. At least what I heard was that they were very close to an agreement between the two governments on extending at least a training mission for the United States in Iraq. And then all of a sudden, sort of in November, the talks collapsed. So I could be mistaken, I suppose, but it seems to me, certainly I can tell you that in the Bush administration, I mean, I was there and I saw it unfold, the schedule for transferring authority back to the Iraqis, for holding elections, the refusal to countenance a delay in the elections. All of this, in my opinion, was dictated by an electoral timetable here in the United States. And I think some of those things also occurred under the Obama administration.
Larry Korb, you were in the Reagan administration. You're now with the liberal think tank, the Center for American Progress. You've, in a sense, been on more than one side of the political spectrum here, or more than one end of it. What do you say to what we just heard?
Well, I think that in terms of Obama, he would have been willing, I think, to leave up to 10,000 troops from everything I know if they could have gotten immunity. But there was no way that the Iraqi parliament was going to approve that, given some of the, you know, the unfortunate incidents that have occurred that Liz was talking about in your previous segment. So I don't really think that was political. I don't think the 2011 thing, you know, that Bush signed had anything to do with the upcoming elections. One of the things that's been missed here was in that agreement that Bush signed. To me, the key thing was in June 2009, our troops basically had to withdraw to their bases and could only go out with the permission of the Iraqis. That to me said that the Iraqis really wanted to take control. And at that time, Maliki said, and I quote, "We've repelled the invaders," which again sends a signal that they wanted to, you know, he wanted to take control their own destiny. So I don't think, you know, I think Obama would have been willing to leave about 10,000, everything that I know, but you know, without immunity, there was no way to do that.
Do you agree with Ambassador Istrabadi that it was a mistake for the United States to support Maliki both within Iraq and in the region?
Well, I agree. I wouldn't have supported him, but I think the key was not just the United States. Don't forget, Iran persuaded Muqtada al-Sadr to, you know, to throw his weight behind Maliki, which kind of got him over the top. I do know that back we were the ones who got him in the first time. I mean, he was clearly our candidate. Whether we could have stopped him, you know, once Muqtada al-Sadr, you know, push them, and the Iranians, from everything I know, wanted him rather than Alawi.
Larry Korb, if in fact he turns out to be a similar leader to Saddam Hussein, and if, as many people suggest, he brings the country much closer to Iran, that was one of the countries where he took refuge when Hussein was in charge, will it all have been for naught as far as the United States is concerned?
Well, I think if you take a look at the Arab Spring, that was tremendous. We had nothing to do with it. You know, whether in fact they would have been able to get rid of Saddam without us, you know, we just, you know, we will not know. Yes, certainly that was a good thing. But as the ambassador said, my best estimate, there were 700,000 Iraqis died plus a million who were, displaced. So if you take a look at it from that, you know, viewpoint, it's really hard to, you know, to justify. And, you know, who would have thought if we were on the program 2 years ago, we'd get rid of Mubarak and Gaddafi. So it may have happened even without us.
Mr. Istrabadi, what about the United States' reputation now in that region and its influence? To what extent has that been lost?
Well, I think that one has to be a little bit careful because the region is not sort of sui generis. You have to look at it country by country. Clearly, there are some resentments in Iraq I think, for the way that the occupation was conducted and for the years since. But again, the large parts of the Arab world, certainly in the Gulf, are under the American security umbrella, where certainly the ruling class is perfectly happy to be. I think that the consequences for U.S. policy will unfold in years to come. Right now, the United States leaves behind a government which is probably, other than Syria, the most pro-Iranian government in the Arab world. It is the only government which the only Arab government which is actively supporting the Syrian government right now. And that I see as an extension of Iranian foreign policy through Iraq. So in that, from that perspective, I think that the United States has done harm to itself. I supported the war in 2003 because I couldn't have imagined any other way for the Iraqis to dislodge Saddam Hussein. Secretary Korb has just talked about, we look at the at what's happened across the Middle East in the last several months, and perhaps that calculation was wrong. Perhaps Saddam might have been capable of being removed without this massive foreign intervention. Again, we'll never know. But the question for me has always been, what does the United States leave behind? And I think what it leaves behind is something that, at least up to the intermediate term, is damaging to U.S. Interests in the region. And so viewed from that perspective, it is damaging to the standing of the United States in the region.
Larry Korb, at the outset, there were concerns that the real reason that the United States was going into Iraq had to do with oil. Yesterday, Mr. Maliki, Prime Minister Maliki, mentioned mentioned American oil companies making deals for Iraqi oil. How important was that?
Well, I think our concern about that whole region has something to do with oil. You know, I mean, if, you know, the main product of that part of the world was carrots, I don't think we would have been, you know, concerned. And that's why when Iraq went into Kuwait, you know, we took action. But I do think that, among other reasons, people thought, well, if this will work well, it'll be the cakewalk. It won't cost us much. Then you'll have, you know, 11 million barrels a day of Iraqi oil coming onto the market. That will help. I mean, that, I'm sure that some people thought about that, but I don't think that's what drove people like, you know, Paul Wolfowitz and people like Dick Cheney. I think they were trying to clean up what they saw as the leftover from the first Gulf War.
Mr. Estrabadi, a final comment from you, if you will. Your sense of America's role in the Middle East and what we ought to be doing now that we're not doing.
Well, I mean, if you extract out abstract out away from Iraq, I think that one thing that would certainly help U.S. prestige in the area would be to actually successfully broker a deal between the Israelis and the Palestinians. That remains a very sore issue in the region. The sort of quadrennial inability of the United States to engage meaningfully is extremely damaging. Every 4 years, as we approach the election cycle, the United States sort of disengages. This is very damaging. And so I hope that we're not about to undergo this again. The events on the ground there do not allow us to remain on the sidelines for another year. In terms of the Arab Spring, so-called, I think that the United States has been doing the right thing in making it very clear where it stands, that it stands on the side of the pro-democracy activists, regardless of what the consequences are.
Thank you both very much for being on our program. Faisal Estrabadi, the former deputy ambassador to the United Nations from Iraq, now at Indiana University, his alma mater, as you mentioned. Larry Korb, now at the Center for American Progress, liberal think tank, formerly with the Reagan administration and the Council of Foreign Relations. Thanks to our other guests, Anthony Cordesman and Liz Sly as well. particle physicist, physics, says that the universe is a vacuum full of particles, including protons and electrons. The big mystery is why the particles have mass. Today, two armies of physicists hinted that they might have found the answer. We'll be back with what they found in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The search for the so-called God particle has led to the biggest manhunt in the history of physics, with two competing groups composed of thousands of scientists each. They have been sifting data from the Large Hadron Collider near Geneva, and this morning thousands of other scientists around the world were waiting for word of what they've been able to find. That's according to Dennis Overby, who writes about science for the New York Times. And Dennis, thanks very much for being on our program.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
This is very tough stuff, especially in a short period of time on the radio, but
it is very hard stuff.
Yeah, what is the God particle? Why does it have to exist?
Well, first of all, the God particle apparently sort of misnamed, because Leon Letterman, a physicist who called it the God particle in a book a few years ago, apparently wanted to call it the goddamn particle, but his editor wouldn't let him. And I get grief every time I use that phrase, because I think it's funny, but some people think that we're treading on religion. Anyway, what it does, so the God, the Higgs boson.
Higgs boson's the same thing.
It's actually the personification, if you might call it, of something called the Higgs field. Now, the Higgs field was theorized by a guy named Peter Higgs and a whole bunch of other people. It sort of pervades the universe kind of like a cosmic molasses. This is the theory. And the way some particles get mass is by trying to move through this molasses, they run into resistance. And the more resistance they run into, the more mass they wind up with. It's sort of like if I were trying to take a walk path through Times Square some afternoon, I could probably slip through the crowd pretty easily. But if I were Lady Gaga on my way to the MTV studios, I probably couldn't get a few steps before I'd be surrounded by some crowd. And so Lady Gaga has mass, and I don't.
Well, now, is this true of all particles or only the God particle? Is it the Lady Gaga particle?
So the way this came about, there's a bunch of theories that kind of go by the very poetic name of the Standard Model. And they describe really everything that particle physicists have been able to measure in their laboratories for the last 35 years. And one thing that it explains, that the force we think of as electromagnetism, which is kind of light, and is actually mathematically identical to a nuclear force called the weak force. And so back in the 1960s, three theorists figured out that mathematically these forces were actually indistinguishable. And this was a great leap forward. It was the first kind of unification of forces since James Clerk Maxwell unified electricity and magnetism 150 years ago. The problem was that electromagnetism, light, is carried by particles called photons. And those are the things that ping out of your television. They make a lot of our electronic devices work. Photons have no mass, and they travel at the speed of light. But the quantum particles that are supposed to be responsible for the weak force, they're called the W and Z bosons. See, this is getting hard. They are quite massive. They're almost as massive as protons, about a tenth as massive as protons. Anyway, they're 80 or 90 billion electron volts, which is...
We're running short of time. As we indicated at the outset, this is tough. Did they find the Higgs boson?
So they've been looking for the Higgs boson for 35 years, and there have been many spurious sightings. And so the rumor was today, there were some rumors that they were going to say they had found it. Or they were going to say that they've found that it doesn't exist. Right now, it could go either way. But right now, the physicists are quite excited because these two different teams, sort of independent groups, both found sort of signals in their data that could be the Higgs boson when they get more data. And these results sort of agree with each other. They're both coming up with the same mass. The big deal is to find what the mass of the Higgs boson is.
But that's what you need. You need more than one experimental verification of something like that.
You need two groups so they can check each other, and this is how things are always done. And before this, there were two groups at Fermilab in Illinois who were doing the same thing. That accelerator is now defunct. It was shut down in September, much to the chagrin of many of us.
But in Geneva, they said they have found hints that this may exist. It looks like two groups have found something similar, but they still, as we run out of time, don't have it.
They don't have it. They hope to be able to say yes or no by next summer.
Dennis Overby, a masterful effort on your part. Thanks a lot for being with us, science reporter for The New York Times. Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Anna Scott and Sonia Geis. Our technical director is Phil Richards. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/to the point. Join us on Facebook. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point from PRI.
PRI, Public Radio International.